From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, Milwaukee County's elections director explains the ballot counting process and when we can expect results. Then we talk to a political science professor about how little the Constitution has to say about the unique situation the 2020 election has presented.
One of the misperceptions that people have about the Constitution is that it provides these very clear answers. In fact, the Constitution is very vague, so there is a lot in American political practice, including our election cycles, that is determined by norms.
Plus, we learn how the Milwaukee Health Department became the first in the nation to recognize the radical racial disparity in COVID-19 deaths.
Earlier in the outbreak, the health department was able to identify our COVID data with ethnicity and race. We were able to do that because of the city council declaring racism a public health crisis.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's Election Day, and while people are heading to the polls, a record number of people voted absentee here in Wisconsin. Because so many people voted early, the timeline for election results is uncertain. But what is for certain is that Milwaukee County election officials have a plan in place for getting all the ballots counted and results out to the public as quickly as possible. Milwaukee County Elections Director Julietta Henry says she expects all the votes cast, whether in person or absentee, to be counted by early Wednesday morning. She is also asking for patience and understanding as they work through this unprecedented process. Henry spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about how ballots are counted, how to best understand the results as they come in, and what they're anticipating on this election day. She begins by explaining the absentee voting process.
So when you cast your ballot at the polling location, you actually place your ballot in a voting machine, the DS-200s. When you vote absentee or in-person absentee, you're simply voting your ballot and placing it in an envelope, and that ballot now is an absentee ballot, and it is opened on election day. So that's the difference. The difference is voting in person on election day or voting absentee. It's in-person absentee. You're not actually early voting. You're just in-person absentee voting.
How are absentee ballots processed?
There are different ways where they're processed. Some ballots are sent directly to the polling location where the poll workers process them. And in Milwaukee County, we have 8 municipalities of the 19 that utilizes a technique called central count. And at those central count locations, they have several voting equipment machines there. And in the city of Milwaukee, they have high-speed machines, and there's 13 high-speed voting machines to process their absentee ballots. So we're able to process about 1,000 to 2,000 ballots per hour once they are opened up on election day. And then at the end of the night, those ballots the results from those ballots off of those machines, they are then sent over to the county via modem. They let us know in advance how many ballots that they have processed, and we're able to look at the number of ballots that were cast at the polling location. And once the ballots that were processed, the absentees, we verify that those numbers are correct.
How do the municipalities tabulate the ballots, like when they're being counted?
They tabulate them by placing them in the voting machines, just like it would be on election day. So one thing that's important to know, if you requested an absentee ballot and you've not mailed that ballot in, you can still go to the polls on election day and you can vote.
Great. So municipalities start counting absentee ballots at 7 a.m. on election day, right?
They can start at 7 a.m. when the polls open. That's when they can start that process.
And what are you expecting in terms of time? I know people are thinking about when they're going to get all the results. What's your analysis of that?
Sure. At this point, because of central count and because of the number of absentee ballots that have been received. We are anticipating finishing this process between 3 o'clock a.m. and 6 o'clock a.m. the morning after the election.
So the city of Milwaukee will probably have over 200,000 ballots, and they can only start counting them, you know, on election day. What's your analysis of why they can get it done, you know, by 3 or 6 a.m.?
Because they have 13 high-speed voting equipments that will allow them to process between 1,000 and 2,000 ballots per hour once they are opened. So we have looked at the numbers. We've spoken to the city, and based on the numbers that we are working with, but the numbers are growing every day as far as the number of individuals who are requesting ballots and or doing the in-person absentee voting. But at this point, we're looking at between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. And as soon as we know better, closer to the election day, that Monday before, we'll definitely know how many ballots and how long it will take them to process them.
And what's your message to people if it takes longer than that, for instance?
If it takes longer than that, we just ask that you be patient, because we want to make sure that every vote is counted and it is counted accurately on the election day. So that is what we'll do. We'll stay here until it's done.
You know, there's going to be results from the precinct from in-person voting, but then there's still going to be a large percentage that's being counted absentee. How should we look at those results? How should we consider them? Because even if 99% of precincts are in this year, it doesn't mean that 99% of ballots have been counted.
Right. So what you'll see is 100% of precincts in. However, we're on our website, we will have a box listing all the municipalities that are utilizing Central Count. Until that box is checked, you'll know that the Central Count is not in. We will also let you know how many ballots are in those various municipalities. So in the city of Milwaukee, for example, if it was today, we would say over 200,000 ballots, and we would give the actual number our absentee ballots, and they are being processed at Central Count. Until this box is checked, then this is the number of ballots that have not been processed at this point. So that is what our plans are for Election Day, to show the public how many ballots are still being processed. And once they have sent those ballots to our office via modem, we will then check that box. So it will now say, City of Milwaukee, it's 100% done. So they have to be 100% in at the polls before we can allow them to start sending in their absentee ballots from Central Count.
And how do we know when there's 100% of absentee ballots in? Do you only know that at 8 p.m. when the polls close? Because then you can't take any more absentee ballots?
Correct. That is correct. As far as ballots that are being received from the clerks, is that what you're requesting?
Yes.
So the clerks, once they will let us know how many ballots they sent out. So we will give you the number of ballots that were mailed, not necessarily the number of ballots that were received, because they're receiving ballots up until 8 o'clock that night, and then they have to enter them into the statewide system with vote to make sure that they're a part of the count. So we'll know how many ballots were mailed, and that is the number that we will add to our list. We will also know how many ballots were in-person absentee voters, and that number will be included in that total number.
And what's happening at the county level on election night?
On election night at the county, we are waiting in city, and 478 reporting units will start coming in after 8 o'clock when the polls close. We will be here until all of those reporting units are in. And once we're at 100%, we will contact those Central Count users, as we stated earlier, and we will ask them to transmit their results via modem. Once we receive those, we verify that information. And at the end of the night, once we are at 100% countywide with all the results being received and accepted, we are able to upload the file to the State of Wisconsin website.
Can you break down what is a canvas? What are they checking for? Who's checking it? You know, that kind of thing.
Sure. We have a group of individuals who work in our office. They are a part of the board of canvassers. there's a list that they follow and they go through. They verify that the tape started at zero and that it's signed by the election inspectors. They verify that at the end of the night, the total ballots cast equals the pink slip, equals the total ballots cast number that the poll workers write in the poll book. So it's a pretty much an audit process. We have step-by-step procedures. If anyone is interested, they can observe the entire process of the office conducting the canvass. It is open to the public. So they go through that process. They verify everything that occurred on election day. If their numbers are off, they look at the inspector statement. So an inspector may say that a person was inadvertently given a ballot for the wrong ward. And so that ward may have one extra ballot in it and one less voter. And then the ward, the sister ward that sits at the same table, they may have one less ballot and one extra person. So when they verify that, they place that information in the inspector statement. And then when we do the canvass, we will know what occurred on election day.
What happens after the canvass? What would they be asserting? And then when does it go to certification? And what is that?
The canvass, we are conducting the canvass beginning on Thursday, November 5th. Our board will open up the canvass that morning. The canvass shall be completed by November 17th. So we will be done at that time. And then we do not certify the election. It is certified by the state. We will only certify the election of the county candidates that were on the ballot for the November 3rd election.
Gotcha. What is a certification? What does that mean?
That means that we've certified the ballots that were counted on election day were accurate in information that we received from every polling location, that we were able to look at that everything was accurate and that it's the total number of ballots cast for that candidate, and we certify who won the election. And they will provide the final election results, I believe, on December 1st.
Juliette Henry, thanks so much, and good luck with the election.
Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Juliette Henry is the Milwaukee County Elections Director. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about how ballots will be counted and results delivered in Milwaukee County. Coming up next, we talk about interpreting the election through the lens of one of the country's founding documents. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Election day is here, but many Wisconsinites have already cast their votes. Because nearly 2 million people in Wisconsin voted early, and because this is not a state where election officials can begin the count before election day, it's not clear when the results will be in. In this unprecedented election, some may look to the Constitution for guidance in a time of political uncertainty. But the long-serving document, like many of us, wasn't necessarily prepared for 2020 and leaves some room for interpretation. Paul Nolet is a professor of political science at Marquette University with a focus on constitutional law and civil liberties. Nolet spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about what the Constitution does and doesn't say about an unusual election like this one.
This election season is really unlike any other. The presidential election, of course, gets the lion's share of the attention when it comes to politics every 4 years. But this year, we're dealing with unprecedented crises at the same time that this major election is happening. So, of course, it's hard to talk about the election without talking about COVID-19 and how that's disrupting things. And that may have an effect on how the vote count for the election goes, too. So you have millions more people this year voting either by mail, absentee ballots, or voting early in person. So many, many more votes are going to be already cast even by the time we get to November 3rd, which is formally election day.
we know it's going to take longer to get the election results, and it's looking more and more likely that we won't know the results of the election at the end of Election Day, and maybe not even for a few days afterward. What does that do to the confidence in our elections?
Well, I think it is important for people to know that these conditions for this election are going to require some extra time, even beyond November 3rd, to make sure that everybody's voice is heard. And so that can continue for days, maybe even a couple weeks after November 3rd, where votes are still being tabulated and counted, especially since many of those mail votes might not be in until November 3rd itself, or even sometimes after. Some states allow ballots that are postmarked by November 3rd to come in after the deadline. So it's going to take some time. Now, that raises the danger that you could have, politicians or party leaders that start claiming that this is evidence of fraud in some ways. But it's important to realize that this is expected. we're in an unprecedented situation where many, many more people are going to be early voting and voting by mail. It's going to take some time to count all of these votes, especially since the vote counters in the various states aren't used to this sort of press of voters voting in this way. So it's going to take some extra time. It does not mean that there's fraud or irregularities going on. And I think that's important for people to realize as we wait patiently for the vote counts coming from the various states.
Yeah, and Wisconsin is one of those states that doesn't usually see this much absentee or early voting, correct?
That's right. There are a few states that are all vote by mail at this point, including Washington State and Oregon, Utah. But most states are kind of like Wisconsin in that they don't have a whole lot of experience with mail voting or even long periods of early voting. And so this is a real shift for Wisconsin. And one other thing that I'd mention about Wisconsin in particular is that it's one of, I believe, only four states that none of the ballots that are coming in can be prepared before Election Day itself, which means that Wisconsin is going to be, I think, even further behind other states in counting the vote. So it's something to be prepared for. We almost certainly won't know who won Wisconsin on Election Day or election night itself. It's going to take some time.
Right. And with that in mind, Wisconsin is expected to play a large role in determining who wins the presidency, maybe an outsized role compared to other states. So what does that mean for that overall confidence and just for the whole election that Wisconsin may be behind in counting ballots?
Yeah, well, it certainly means that all eyes will be on Wisconsin, which we kind of know already. You know, anytime you turn on the TV and see the barrage of ads towards Wisconsin voters in the lead up to the election. But certainly, I mean, Wisconsin, because it will be perhaps even a few days behind other states in counting the votes, if it turns out that Wisconsin, like it was in 2016, is a decisive state in the election, then it could all come out to the vote count. So it's one of these situations where I think it's important that all of us have patience during this process. I know it's a very anxious time for many who follow politics, but it's also we want to make sure that all votes are counted and counted fairly and correctly.
But there's so many factors that are going into this election, to this year. You know, it's hard to keep track of all the things that are weighing in on this year's election. There's the threat of foreign interference, the president's refusal to commit to a peaceful transfer of power if there is a change, and the encouragement of people watching the polls, outside groups or just other people. What are these challenges going to mean for the trust in our election system and the trust when it takes a few days to find out the results?
Yeah, and no doubt about it, I am worried about that. I think one thing that has been remarkable about American democracy and American elections is this concept of a peaceful transition of power. You know, the very first time it happened, John Adams lost to Thomas Jefferson in the election of 1800. It wasn't clear what Adams was going to do. He wasn't happy about it, by the way. He really thought that Thomas Jefferson would not be a good president, and was not happy about this transfer of power, but he turned over power. And that set the tone for elections to come. And this peaceful transition of power, even when it goes from one party to the other, or one ideology to the other. And so when President Trump has failed to commit to a peaceful transition of power, this is worrisome in terms of chipping away at that norm that's been around since the very first transition of power in the United States in 1800. So it's a longstanding tradition, but like a lot of norms and tradition, those things can go by the wayside if people aren't serious about it. And I am worried that that could be chipped away with all the various challenges that you mentioned to this particular election cycle.
And this idea of a peaceful transfer of power, of accepting the election results as presented, as, you know, confirmed, it's not written into our Constitution. It's a norm, like you said, and we've seen, you know, several years of breaking norms. So to you, what do you think about the fact that that isn't a law, that that isn't in our Constitution?
Yeah, and, you know, there's, I think one of the misperceptions that people have about the Constitution is that it provides these very clear answers on all this various things. In fact, the Constitution is very vague overall. It's remarkably short, especially compared to other constitutions around the world, and it doesn't give a lot of the answers. So there is a lot in American political practice, including our election cycles, that is determined by norms and is reliant on these norms going from election to election and even in the day-to-day political practice in the United States. And so these norms are particularly important since the Constitution doesn't spell it out. And that's why commitment to those norms and all of the parties involved and politicians involved in elections need to commit to these norms because it's really crucial, the backbone of American democracy, since, again, just looking at the Constitution is not going to be able to give the answers to all of these questions. One of the things to be perhaps revisited after this election cycle is which of these norms actually need to be built into the Constitution. So, I mean, a good example of this is the two-term limit for the presidency, which was a norm that was established by George Washington, so very early on, and presidents adhered to that norm. But then when, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was the first to break that norm, very shortly after Congress passed and the states ratified an amendment to limit formally in the Constitution the presidential term, or limit to two terms. And so something like that may need to happen after this, where we just need to spell out something specifically in the Constitution so it's even more solid than just an informal norm and becomes really part of constitutional requirements.
Do you think conditions in the country are ripe for a constitutional crisis? And what would that look like?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much going on that the possibility of a constitutional crisis, I think, is in fact elevated. Now, what does that look like? Well, it could be a range of things. It could be anything from, well, a lot of people are getting worried about the delayed vote count. There's allegations, false allegations of fraud coming perhaps from President Trump or others. And that's undermining the public faith in the election. That could be part of a constitutional crisis. I mean, a perhaps even more disturbing one would be if you, in fact, have, say, armed, you know, vigilantes out in the streets basically threatening election officials or others. I mean, we've had stories in recent days of, you know, small groups of armed people threatening to kidnap the Michigan governor, for instance, and other politicians around the country. If that sort of effort grows and you actually have you armed groups, perhaps on both the right and the left, in the streets, I mean, that's a real recipe for disaster, I think. So, I mean, a constitutional crisis could look like that, too. And of course, anytime that you're talking about the Constitution, ultimately, the courts could get involved and the U.S. Supreme Court. And that, too, just to add to the whole layering of all the craziness going on, of course, we have this whole fight over the nomination after Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death, and with many Democrats really questioning the legitimacy of the court and how where that stands, too. So if the court plays a major role in a constitutional crisis in some ways, that spurs its own constitutional crisis. So on the one hand, I don't want to get too alarmist here. America's dealt with a lot of crises in the past, including obviously a civil war, Great Depressions, multiple foreign wars as well, economic crises, and even pandemics in the past, and ultimately weathered those. But do I have concerns about a possible constitutional crisis? Absolutely. I mean, there's so much going on in 2020.
Yeah, so much going on, to put it lightly. I don't think that anyone has been able to keep up with every single event that has happened this year by a long shot. When people hear the words constitutional crisis, what are they supposed to interpret from that? How does that affect your regular person who hears this could mean a constitutional crisis? Does it mean our Constitution is in question? You know, like, what does that mean?
Well, I think in this case, because the Constitution doesn't give many clear answers to the questions that we face, it's a real crisis of constitutional norms, I think, going back to that question of norms. Again, if a lot of these norms go by the wayside, then it really opens up the possibility that there could be anything from allegations of fraud to increased foreign interference to even violence on the streets. When that happens. And of course, that all has an effect on us, specifically, both in terms of who our leadership is and potentially even in our very own communities if there is, in fact, violence that comes out of this. So, I mean, a constitutional crisis is perhaps too obvious to say not a good thing. I mean, I think most people like stability and they like certainty and they like to know that the constitutional system is secure, but that a lot of that's on us. You know, we can't point. Ultimately, the Constitution is a piece of paper, right, that potentially could be ignored, or those constitutional norms that come out of it could be put by the wayside if we're not serious about maintaining them. So I think it's really on all of us to, you know, Republicans, Democrats alike, independents, to really have a commitment to things like the peaceful transition of power that we've seen for decades and even centuries in the United States.
And is there anything else that you're paying close attention to when it comes to how this election is going to go, the issues it could raise with the Constitution, or just generally the issues it could raise with the norms and our systems of government?
There's a few different things that are really constitutionally problematic, in which the Constitution doesn't give us necessarily much in the way of answers. And I'll mention one that perhaps is on the morbid side, but should be mentioned since both candidates are in their 70s, which is what happens, you know, on top of all the craziness already, if, you know, one of the candidates dies during that period before the Electoral College votes, or even before, you know, Inauguration Day on January 20th. And if something like that happens, you know, perhaps surprisingly, the Constitution doesn't say anything about this. And it would really open up some questions about how somebody ought to be replaced. Certainly at this point, it's far too late to replace anybody on the actual ballot. But what would happen if the electors are trying to figure out who they're going to vote for if the candidate who they're pledged to actually has died? So, again, this is not a likely scenario. I think some of the other things that we talked about is more likely, like false allegations of fraud over the week after Election Day, for instance. But it is an unlikely scenario that would raise a number of additional constitutional questions that are unanswered by the text itself. So it's just another thing to think about as we barrel towards the weeks and months before Inauguration Day in January.
And is there anything that you've seen that assuages your concerns or brings relief to the concerns you have so far in the way people are early voting or just the way that the election is being handled in Wisconsin?
Well, I think election officials, I think, are doing a great job under very difficult circumstances. You know, they're trying, they're collecting these ballots. They can't quite prepare them in Wisconsin, unlike in most states, but they're getting them ready. And I have confidence that they're going to do as good a job as they possibly can in counting these ballots. And I am heartened by the fact that both in Wisconsin and across the country, we're seeing already just enormous turnout even before Election Day. So voting by mail and early voting, both of which are available here in Wisconsin. And we see numbers that suggest that turnout is going to be way up even in comparison to 4 years ago, 2016, and may in fact even shatter some records for presidential turnout. So looking back 2 years ago in 2018 during the midterm election, that was one of the highest turnouts for a midterm election in decades. And we might see something similar in a presidential election this year. So I am heartened by the millions of people in Wisconsin and across the country who are exercising their right to vote and want their voice heard in this election.
Paul Nolet is a professor of political science at Marquette University with a focus on constitutional law and civil liberties. He spoke with Lakefex Becca Schimmel about this year's election and the challenges a vague constitution presents. Coming up, the chief of staff for the Milwaukee Health Department talks about the city's response to the pandemic and what they've learned so far. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The COVID-19 pandemic is at an all-time high in Wisconsin. So far, more than 2,000 Wisconsinites have died of COVID-19, and nearly a quarter of a million have been sickened. The disease has disproportionately impacted communities of color, but thanks to Milwaukee's declaration of racism as a public health crisis, the city has been able to identify these disparities and work towards mending them. Lily Ann Payne was instrumental in creating this declaration. Payne is the chief of staff for the Milwaukee Health Department, and she joins Lake Fextoy Powers to talk about her work and the pandemic.
Lily Ann, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Going into this pandemic, I think like a lot of people, I was not terribly prepared. But, you know, the city health department, of course, does have these kinds of plans to figure out, you know, what we should do during a crisis. Did you feel like you were prepared for a pandemic like we're experiencing right now?
That's a great question. A pandemic like we're experiencing right now has not been experienced before. The dry run of this or trial run of an emergency preparedness event that most people look back to is H1N1. And then when it comes to relief efforts, people reference the Hurricane Katrina time period of what true leadership looks like from a federal level to a state level to a local level. That has been the point of reference in this current pandemic.
Yeah. You know, as you mentioned, in the past, there has been a lot more federal guidance. And in general, in other countries, we've seen a lot of guidance coming from the federal government. That's kind of what you expect, especially in a, you know, worldwide pandemic, as all pandemics are. What has that looked like here in the U.S.? And has that guidance or lack thereof impacted how you do your work on a daily basis?
With this being a novel virus, COVID-19 or coronavirus, there are things that we've learned and can look back to since the declaration of the emergency back in March here in Milwaukee. I believe folks began globally speaking about it before the United States. Some point back and say this may have began in late November, December of 2019. And when looking at the response, it's only fair to say, because it's a new strain of virus, people were going off of the information that was available at the time at different points of this pandemic. It was a test, and really for some, an introduction to what public health is and can do when it is funded, fully funded. And at this point in our response to the pandemic, it is magnifying and amplifying where funding is and is not for public health.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned, of course, funding for public health, especially at the state level, at the municipality level, really fluctuates, especially in a state like Wisconsin that has had, you know, its fair share of financial difficulties. Has that complicated your work?
That's a great question. I'm interpreting your question about the availability of funds on a state level and how that may or may not influence our ability to perform standard public health. And I want to give a huge shout out to the leadership at the Milwaukee Health Department, acknowledge our mayor, who is our CEO essentially, for shoring up and leveling up what leadership looks like in hard times. We have an amazing lab director. We have an amazing medical director. We have an amazing deputy commissioner for environmental health, as well as our policy innovation and engagement. And it's a relatively new leadership team. So we have worked with what we were given. We've made lemonade out of lemons, so to speak, to ensure the public health and safety of our residents.
When it comes to state funding here in Milwaukee, we often have a lot of complaints about how that's doled out, in part because it's been stagnant for about two decades now. When it comes to a pandemic, there are all of these new costs that come up, and it seems like the Department of Health at the city level has been doing what it can. Has there been any indication that the state will loosen up some funds, will bring out more money to support city health departments like Milwaukee's, of course, but also Madison and other cities around the state?
We are in budget season as we speak. The mayor will be announcing what our 2021 budget will be in a matter of weeks. And I think during this pandemic, there has been a lot of support through CARES dollars that are only available until the end of the year. So as a health department, we have relied heavily on and created new partnerships with sectors that can help fill in the gaps that we may have. A key example of that is looking at our COVID-19 testing sites and what that was like in the beginning of the declared emergency with our various healthcare sectors here and players, what that communication was as far as sharing with the public the information we had about symptoms and a mask wearing and its effectiveness, and working closely with neighborhood services to identify supports for food security and home security. A lot of things that we are experiencing right now were taking place prior to this pandemic. It's just magnifying the need and the great work that is happening behind the scenes. We have a lot of unsung heroes that work in public health, and a lot of public and private sector relationships that have become stronger to, again, support the health and well-being of our residents.
Well, and kind of fill in some of those funding gaps, it seems.
I would say addressing a need. There has been a collaboration with Mask Up MKE to get masks out. There have been, with the Greater Milwaukee Foundation and the Milwaukee Civic Leadership Group, different work groups that have worked on mental health, child care, actual housing and grocery shopping for those that are in isolation or quarantine. I would say it's a consortium of direct service with public health, filling in the gaps for those that have experienced unemployment or were experiencing unemployment prior to the pandemic, and childcare as schools have reopened in a hybrid format. So I would say it's more so a collaboration or a consortium of direct service, nonprofit, and public health coming together to fill in gaps as much as possible, because there's always been that need. It's just greater amplified during a pandemic.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect, and I'm speaking with Lillianne Payne. She's the chief of staff for the Milwaukee Health Department. One of the gaps that exists here in Milwaukee, but really around the country, probably around the world, is really an information gap. There's a lot of misinformation that's getting out to people, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about the information that we're given. So when you think about what the average person in the community understands about COVID-19, what are some of the things that you think or have seen people still misunderstand about this pandemic?
That is something we have tried to address and will continue to address with the findings of our Advancing Healthier Wisconsin grant to stop COVID-19. That's how we refer to it in the health department. It's a partnership with the Medical College of Wisconsin and the Center of Emergency Medicine, also at Frederick. And with those particular funds, the overarching goal of that collaboration was to develop key messaging around COVID-19 and its impact to the First Nation demographic, African American demographic, Latinx demographic, and the Southeast Asian Pacific demographic. Earlier in the outbreak, first in the nation, the health department was able to identify our COVID data with ethnicity and race. We've been like a model for that. We were able to do that because of the city council declaring racism a public health crisis, which the county was also able to do that, modeling after the Wisconsin Public Health 2018 resolution, declaring racism as a public health crisis. So the framing of community conditions for those that have been historically disenfranchised and how this virus has shown up and has taken lives. So the misinformation is earlier on that you got it because you traveled to a certain region, then it turned into this was a virus that was taking out African-American men, and that spread to our Latinx community, and it caused people to pause and reevaluate what that lived experience has been, again, for marginalized communities. And based on that disaggregation of data, we could prioritize the African-American community. I'm thinking back to March, and frame our words around basic hygiene that the CDC was sharing as far as guidance, properly washing your hands, sneezing into your elbow, not touching your eyes or mouth, limiting contact, right? We didn't understand that it was an airborne virus earlier in March and what that meant for the Black community. I mean, there's intergenerational housing. A lot of those that are employed during a pandemic are frontline workers. And we learned that the gatherings of small people at weddings, funerals, and birthday celebrations, that's how it was spreading, because it was airborne, because it lived on surfaces, and communicating that in a way that was culturally relevant and appropriate. And doing the same for Latinx, our First Nation folks, and Southeast Asian Pacific Islanders. So again, an opportunity to partner with healthcare systems, direct service folks, and also apply a racial equity lens to our outreach efforts and communication efforts, really embodying how we mitigate racism as a public health crisis.
Yeah, you mentioned racism as a public health crisis. And I remember when that started making a lot of headlines, there were people who, you know, asked, well, what does that mean? And how does that How does declaring it a public health crisis do anything? What does that ultimately do? And it seems like, at least in this case, it's allowed us to zero in on communities that are struggling more, especially right now because of the pandemic. Can you explain how that works, how that announcement led to these kinds of changes?
I would be happy to do that. The way this story has been told publicly, unfortunately, at times erases the blueprint that was created for all of this work. And I'm a key player in how that blueprint came to be. I served as the at-large director for the board of directors for the Wisconsin Public Health Association between 2017 and 2019. I was the founding member of what is now a racial equity committee, but was a racial equity work group for the Wisconsin Public Health Association. And the impetus behind declaring racism as a public health crisis for a membership-based organization, the largest membership-based organization for the state of Wisconsin that is responsible for the professional development of who is now working as health officers and emergency preparedness folks and lab directors during this pandemic, was to really shine a light on the lived experience that I and others that identify as Black and Indigenous people of color have had, and those that live closest to the problem are the solution makers. And in order to communicate in a way that public health officials could understand, the language that was available to us, to me, through my visionary leadership was a resolution. And when you look at health disparities, you look at the distributions of opportunities, the unfair distributions and the unfair benefits that some may have had, just as this pandemic is exposing and magnifying. And that work helped and is continuing to help public health in Wisconsin reimagine what workforce development looks like, reimagine what leadership looks like, and also recognizing the harm and unintended consequences of decisions that have been made that have negatively impacted Black and Indigenous people of color. So within public health context, we're looking at health outcomes. When you look at how the county has adopted and rectified WPHA's resolution, when you look at how the city has rectified it, when you look at how the health department has rectified it, it has turned into true policy change that requires racial impact statements, requires us to look at the unintended consequences of decision making that our leaders have made and will make, like when we look at budgets, when we look at identifying initiatives, when we look at developing better partnerships. That again is magnified during a pandemic. So it started out with Wisconsin Public Health Association. The audience was a membership-based public health trained group of folks. And I believe the county declared it first and then the city. So that was like May and July of 2019, not knowing that a pandemic was going to take place in late 2019 and 2020. And it's predicted to last until 2021, maybe 2022. And it's really making sure that we are intentional about who we are serving, how we are serving them, and that just and fair and equitable outcomes can be made for all of our residents, not just for the city of Milwaukee, but for the state. And it's now turned into a wave. So I want to say the nation, right? You have so many states that have adopted that.
Well, and hopefully, as we've seen in this pandemic, it's going to lead to, at the very least, an understanding of how diseases impact different communities disparately.
Yes, at the very least, yes.
When you look back at what has almost been, well, let's say half a year, when you look back, though, at this pandemic, what's the most valuable thing you've learned so far, and how are you carrying that lesson, these lessons, into the future?
The most valuable thing I've learned so far are the qualities of a great leader and what leadership means. And those characteristics that I've appreciated and that people have stepped into and stepped up for our humility, empathy, communicating in a sense of trust, having controlled emotions, self-confidence when being challenged and held accountable. That's what I'm learning and aspiring to and expecting of others. And I would like that to be something that is just a given post this pandemic.
Lily Ann Payne is the Chief of Staff for the Milwaukee Health Department, and she spoke with LakeVec's Joy Powers. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.